All righty. Thanks very much, Ryan Burrow. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch, a Thursday afternoon. A lot to talk about today. Let's jump right into it. Ian Scherer is on a phone line from CNET, and he joins us to talk about issues in the tech world, innovation, and all of that. And Ian, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
How are you doing?
Good. I want to start, and we don't have a lot of time today, unfortunately, but we could any minute now get this ruling from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on the temporary immigration ban put in place by Donald Trump, the president. And I know tech is pretty strongly against it. Did they file an amicus brief?
Yeah, they did. And it was an 18-page argument that they filed with the court here in San Francisco. And the big thing that they say is that, look, we're a nation of immigrants. And what they argue is that this could significantly impact their businesses. And this is, by the way, why you see so many tech industry companies coming out against this. I think there was nearly 100 of them got involved in this. And it was a big deal for them because so many of their employees come from overseas. They're either computer experts that come from places like India or Eastern Europe or China. They come from all over, really.
Okay, so in the story written by Katie Collins, she says that that one thing that might result in this is that some of these tech companies might then move out of the U.S. or move some of their operations out of the U.S. to have greater access to immigrants. Is that a realistic threat?
I mean, it's an interesting issue, right? Look, it would be very hard for Apple to upend itself and move to some other place. But it's worth noting that almost every one of these companies have overseas headquarters, secondary headquarters they've already set up. Apple has a huge one in Ireland. You've got a bunch of companies now saying they're going to consider moving out of Britain, where they've set up a lot of their secondary headquarters. And so companies have become truly international, and they're not tied to the United States like they once were. In fact, there are a number of companies in the United States who have multiple headquarters inside the United States so they can move around based on tax laws. Okay,
But so the Apple situation in Ireland and the people leaving for breakfast, those are economic issues, not necessarily people issues. I mean, do you think that the immigration access would have that great of an impact?
I mean, I don't know, but let me say this. There is, when you consider how big a pipeline of immigrants are to the tech industry and how reliant it is upon them because they really are searching for the best of the best wherever they can find them, it is something that if it became an issue where they couldn't have enough engineers, and let's point out, there's already a problem in Silicon Valley where they don't have enough people right now. They are paying obscene amounts of money to people because they can't find enough engineers to build iPhone apps and all this other stuff and people who have the expertise. So they're going overseas already. So if it becomes a problem for them, yeah, it's very reasonable that they could start building up their overseas populations more, and whatever's in the United States becomes less important.
All right.
And that's bad for the United States.
There's that. Those are the world's problems. Let's have a little more fun now. 2016 was going to be the year of virtual reality. Is 2017 going to be the year that people said, what was 2016 all about anyway?
Yeah, you know, it's a real problem. So you've got Oculus, which is this company that Facebook bought for $3 billion. They make the most high-profile headsets. They're called the Rift. And they had these stores. If you went to a Best Buy, you would likely see in there an opportunity to try it out. They had 500 of these across the country. Well, it turns out they're going to close nearly half of them. And they tried to say, look, you know, we make changes all the time and stuff. But a lot of people are reading into this as the first real sign that maybe VR isn't selling as well as people at home.
Is it because there's not so much to do with VR? I mean, you're limited in what you can do right now. People are just going to wait a little longer?
I think it's partially that. There's definitely not that much content when you compare it to stuff like your phone or your PlayStation or Xbox. But there's other parts of this, too, which is that people still have to wrap their heads around how it works, right? You don't really understand VR until you try it out yourself. And then you have to be willing to spend a lot of money to get a good VR experience. It costs you up to $1,500.
I know that they say, and they say the best way to do it is to have an in-store sort of demonstration. So you've got to be willing to really look like a goof in front of people you don't know.
Well, that gets back to why this is a bad sign, right? It's the most important part of this right now is marketing it and getting headsets on people's faces. And if you're not going to be doing that, there's only one reason, really, I can think of why they wouldn't be, and that's because it's not doing as well as they'd hoped, which is a bad sign. I mean, they've been trying to sell this stuff for decades.
Right.
This right now is the hardest push that you've ever seen, and a ton of money going into it. And it's a real question. Are we in a bubble? I don't know. But that's a bad sign.
That's Ian Schur. You can read much more at CNET.com. Ian, great to talk to you again. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
It's 12:24. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, when I was a kid in Manteno, Illinois, it was an all-volunteer fire department. So that meant when there was an ambulance call or a fire or whatever, there'd be sirens on phone poles around town, and they would all sound. And then the guys with the blue lights in their cars would jump in. They'd race to the fire department. They'd get in the trucks, and they'd take off. And then I, as a kid, would climb my telephone, not my telephone pole, but my TV antenna in the back of the house. And I would climb above the roof line to where I could see the entire town and the surrounding countryside to see where the fire trucks were going. It's changed a lot in Manteno since then, but maybe not so much around much of the state. 70% of Illinois' fire departments are volunteers, and they're having a hard time finding volunteers to man the stations. Al Yancey is the fire chief in Minooka, and he's also heading up the Volunteer and Combination Officer Committee for the Illinois Fire Chiefs Association. He joins us on a phone line now. Al, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
How is everything? Everything safe in Minooka this afternoon?
Yes, it is. Everything's going well. Thank you.
I was shocked to hear that 70% of the fire departments in the state are still volunteer. How do we compare with other states?
Most of the country is volunteer, predominantly volunteer departments across our nation. So we're in comparison with a lot of other states. Volunteer departments are those first line of fire protection in many communities across Illinois and across the country.
You know, and as I was talking about my experience as a young guy, but it's really part of the community. When you see men, and I'm sure now women as well, who volunteer, who are driving their cars to the station to get in the truck and go out and fight. I mean, that's like fighting the barn fire in the Old West or whatever like that. It's a real sort of community building endeavor.
Yeah, it's very much about the community. They're volunteer departments of people that are operating in those communities. And a lot of times these days, people are leaving those communities to go to work somewhere else. And they're not available to run those fire trucks out. And a lot of times their departments are dealing with us during the daytime hours. Nighttime, sometimes it gets a little better because people are back into their community.
Well, how bad is the situation? How bad is the shortage?
Well, we've seen in Illinois that we hear a lot about declining volunteers. And back in 2006, the Illinois Fire Chiefs Association did a statewide survey and found that we're just seeing a significant decline in volunteer, which goes along with what's going on around the country. And part of that was we saw that there needed to be something done to address recruitment and retention. And so the Illinois Fire Chiefs Association and our committee sought to get a grant through FEMA to help local departments at that level do recruitment and retention for the local community.
Well, you got the grant, right? I think it's $1.3 million. What are you going to do with it?
Well, we've had the grant for a few years now, and the grant is actually coming to a close here in May of this year. So for the past 4 years, we've been working around the state with all kinds of different programs to help educate the local volunteer fire chief and local leadership on how to recruit those firefighters, and then once you get them in the door, how to retain them for longevity.
And how is it different now? Why is it that people aren't volunteering? Is that sense of community diminished a little bit?
I think it's because people are just very busy, very, very busy in life, lots of things going on, kids' activities going on many times a day, and just people are busier. People are just generally busier, and volunteering to be a firefighter is time-consuming. It takes a lot of training to initially get your training to get the kind of education you need to be a safe and effective firefighter, and that becomes difficult too. And part of what we teach them in our workshops for the leadership is you have to value that volunteer's time. He has a little bit of time, and you have to make sure you're able to use that wisely. And then we also teach them that there are people in your community, not everyone wants to be an interior firefighter. Someone may just want to drive the fire truck.
Right, right.
And other people may want to be on your water rescue team.
Well, we're just about out of time, but so you're saying the grant is up in May. Are you waiting to hear if you're going to get a renewal of that grant?
This grant ends, so we're looking at the possibility of reapplying through FEMA to get another grant. We have to go through the application process again.
Well, I wish you the best of luck. Al Yancey, the fire chief at Minooka, but looking out for departments around the state. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks again for having me.
Thanks very much, Ryan Burrow. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wind Trust Business Lunch on 720 WGN 1239. On this Thursday afternoon, Elise Glink is on a phone line. Elise is the publisher of ThinkLink.com, the CEO of Best Money Moves. We talked about that a lot. It's an HR app for businesses that helps employees measure their financial stress, the workers' stress, and then dial it down a little bit. You can find out more about that at Glink.com, ThinkLink.com. Elise, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Thanks, Steve.
So, you know, talking about employees' stress, two things. You know, a lot of people aren't, but a lot of people are worked up about what's coming out of Washington. So you've got that. And then maybe their concerns are eased, or their stress is eased a bit when they go check their 401k. The Dow's up well over 100 points again today. Things are looking rosy there.
Yeah, it is nice to have the Dow up. Remember, though, that the Dow isn't about all the stocks that are on the stock market, right? It really looks at a very narrow focus. And in fact, there are sort of categories of or verticals of companies that are actually not doing so well. So it does feel good that if you just have the 30 stocks or so that are in the Dow, you're going to feel great about where you are. Overall, people do see that their 401ks are going up. And in fact, I talked to a bunch of housing economists this week, and I'll be reporting on this for my syndicated column, but the housing economists are saying that the stock market rising is giving people the perception that they have more money, even as housing is becoming more and more unaffordable, both because of rising interest rates, overall rising interest rates, and because of housing prices, which in many markets are climbing to all-time highs.
So, that's what, good or bad? Maybe we're overspending, but it's sparking the market a little bit?
Well, if you feel good about yourself, right. It doesn't really matter.
I'd rather feel good than be good, my friend.
I would rather feel good, but I'd rather know that I'm not buying at the high again for housing. And so some people are very concerned because when you've got a housing prices rising, that's great, but that also means that first-time homebuyers have a tougher time getting into the market. There are very few homes on the market relative to the household formation numbers. Those have returned to normal. We're seeing about 1.1 to 1.2 million households form in a year, but we're not seeing nearly that many new houses come on the market. And so it's very interesting to watch housing unaffordability and some of the new numbers that we're seeing.
Let's go back to Wall Street and stocks. Twitter is, that's part of the NASDAQ, is it not?
It is.
Okay.
And it's not doing so well today.
Well, so they're down, I think, 10% after their earnings came in well below what Wall Street was expecting. I was in the stock, I think, right now is, well, I don't have what it is. It's, I should have it in front of me.
It was down at about 15, 16 bucks at about 9:30 this morning, and I think it's probably somewhere around $16, $17 a share right now, or 16 and a half.
I bring it up because in getting ready to talk to you, I found an article on thestreet.com from 2013, and the headline is Why Twitter Will Be at 100 by the End of the Year.
Oh, my gosh. Remember those days? Boy, that was really something. So Twitter's been kind of an interesting story. I think we hear more about Twitter now than we've heard in the last 3-4 years. You know, they were having a tremendous amount of growth, and then Donald Trump has found it to be the medium of choice for communicating with the American public,
and whatever. And everybody's going there. Their usage, I think, is up 10 or 11% since the president was elected. So it has become this great focus and sort of great town square that the president, and because of that, the country and maybe the world is using. They can't make money.
Yeah, they're not making as well. Okay, revenue in the fourth quarter was $717 million, which is up, you know, 1% from a year earlier. It just missed expectations of $740 million. So they do have revenue. Let's not, you know, let's not cry for Jack Dorsey just yet. But the a year earlier, the revenue growth was 48%. And one of the things about value companies, the way investors think versus, say, growth companies, is if you've got a growth company, you've got a huge price-to-earnings ratio, you're expecting massive, massive growth. And in fact, Twitter in the last period only added 1 to 2 million subscribers. Compare that to Facebook, which is now at, I think, 1.6 billion people are using it maybe every day. And so not only is Facebook doing a better job of monetizing those people, their growth is still big, even at a number most people would say it would be impossible to grow that big.
But Twitter is different in that it's a little more, I think, immediate and topical, instantaneous perhaps. So should they be trying to sell themselves in a way different from Facebook? I know they're both really pushing live content right now. I don't know if Twitter can keep up there.
I don't know. You know, it's hard when you're trying to mimic somebody else's growth when your style and your product is completely different.
Right.
So I think where they've fallen down the path, Steve, is that they're not introducing the kind of ad sales vehicles that companies are really liking. They may also not have as strong a sales force as Facebook does and Google does, going out there and really pushing companies to buy mobile ads. And that, of course, is where most of the growth is going. So it'll be interesting to see how, you know, they think that the revenue growth is going to continue to lag, as their COO said, audience growth. So they think that revenue growth will be lower than the number of people using Twitter, and they're refocusing the product mix. So it could be even lower over the next quarter. So it'll be interesting to see how they pull themselves out of this thing. I asked you a couple of weeks ago, what would happen if we were in a Twitter-free world?
I can't imagine it. I really can't. I mean, that sounds silly. Let me try it. No, can't imagine it.
No, it's crazy, especially with, you know, Donald Trump controlling real Donald Trump and also POTUS. And together it's like 50 million followers. Probably some are the same, but maybe some aren't. It's really interesting to think about communication in this country without Twitter right now.
It would be completely different. Elise Glink, thank you very much for joining us today again. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. See you soon.
It's 12:53. This is the Business Lunch on 720 WG, and I'm Steve Bertrand. Thanks very much for tuning in. I appreciate that. Hope you'll follow me on Twitter while it still exists, at Steve Bertrand, or on Facebook. There's a Steve Bertrand page there. All right, so are you married? Have a live-in boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife? Do you have a secret credit card? Apparently, a lot of us do. The creditcard.com says 12 million of us do, creditcards.com. Matt Schultz is a senior industry analyst with them, and he joins us now on the Business Lunch. Matt, welcome to the Biz Lunch.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's start close to home. Do you have a secret credit card account?
No, I sure don't, and I wouldn't advise anybody else to have one either.
All right, so what's this? You did this study, and that came up with a number of 12 million Americans, which, I mean, by percentages, it's not a huge percentage, right? That's 5% maybe of people who are married or live with a spouse or significant other?
Yeah, it's right around 5%. So it's not a giant number, but anytime you're talking about, you know, double-digit millions of people who have something, it's still a significant thing.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a lot of people keeping a secret that they shouldn't be keeping.
And so I was reading a story that you guys had on your website at creditcards.com, and it was interesting to me that there was a, I don't know if it was a therapist or who exactly or what her title was or role, but she said that a lot of this financial secrecy comes from our desire to hold on to our identity, to sort of maintain an individuality. So we're married, we're part of a couple, everything is shared. If you hang on to this little bit, it's not so much about sneaking money or hoarding money, it's about trying to maintain some independence. What do you make of that?
I think there's something to be said for that. I think there are any number of reasons why you could have an account. It could be wanting to exert a little individuality. It could be something like somebody in an abusive relationship stashing money away to help them when they walk away from that. It could be somebody who is saving money for an engagement ring and doesn't want the other to know. So it's not always necessarily a negative thing.
Or it could be someone who just wants to keep the money to themselves.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And the truth is that when it comes down to it, being honest and open about your money and your relationship is really the best way to go.
It can get you in trouble, right? I mean, that's the sort of thing where if you're not both on the same page when it comes to finances, that could cause trouble down the road.
Yeah, especially if one is a free spender and the other one is not, it can really cause a lot of frustration. And that's really the type of thing that you need to have a conversation about before you walk down the aisle. Otherwise, it can really, really cause some difficult conversations.
Yeah, I was interested, too, in these numbers because, and maybe this makes sense, because the older you are, generally, up until a point perhaps, the older you are, the more money you have and maybe the more disposable or hideable income you have. And that kind of is reflected in the survey, isn't it, that baby boomers, older baby boomers, are more likely to have these secret accounts than our millennials.
Yeah, it did make sense. And for all of the reasons that you said, along with the fact that millennials are kind of famously credit averse and have tended to shy away from credit because they don't want to pile on any more debt along with their student loan debt.
So they're a little more attuned to all of that and being upfront too, I would imagine.
Yeah, and millennials also famously share everything, as you can see on any millennials' Facebook
right.
page and social media accounts.
All right, Matt Schultz, Senior Industry Analyst for CreditCards.com. I got to run pay my other Visa bill.
Good talking with you.
Nice to talk to you as well.